In July of 1984, on a hot night in Burlington, North Carolina, 22-year-old college student Jennifer Thompson was sleeping in her apartment after coming home from a date. Unbeknownst to her, a man had broken the light bulb outside of her back door, cut her telephone line, and pried open her door. He was crawling along the floor in her bedroom when Jennifer suddenly woke up. She started to scream, but then stopped when she felt a knife blade against her throat. She whispered that she would give the man her money, her credit cards, even her car, if he would just leave her alone. When he replied he didn't want any of those things, she knew she was about to be raped. During the attack, one solitary thought continued to cycle through Thompson's mind, keeping her focused. She was going to live. She was determined to live. And because of that, she needed to study her rapist's face, his voice, look for scars or tattoos on his body, memorize his clothing, try to estimate his height by comparing it to her own body. In short, take in every detail she possibly could. That way, if police were somehow able to find this man, she could definitely identify him. Because she could smell he had been drinking, Jennifer thought she might have a mental advantage over her attacker, since she clearly didn't have any physical advantage. She decided to try to escape by using her wits. During the assault, Jennifer thought maybe the man knew her from somewhere, but then realized more likely he must have been tracking her or at least looking around her home for a while before she woke up. He knew her name, knew she was from Winston-Salem, and thought she had a boyfriend in Germany, since there were postcards in her apartment from Germany signed by a man, though the mail was actually from her brother. She didn't know it at the time, but the alcohol in his breath was beer taken from her own refrigerator and liquor from her cabinet. When Jennifer heard him call her baby, even though it sickened her, perhaps subconsciously she thought he wanted a cooperative victim. Plus, she had heard that one of the worst things a woman can do during a rape is to fight, since that just exaggerates the sense of control the rapist is trying to exert. Jennifer told her attacker she would feel much more relaxed if he got rid of the knife and asked him nicely to put it outside of her front door. She thought maybe that if he complied, she could rush after him, close the door, lock it, and then call for help. She had no idea her phone line had already been cut. The man actually agreed to put the knife outside, but insisted that she go into the bathroom while he did so. She realized she'd have to think of another plan. Next, Jennifer said she was really thirsty and needed to go to the kitchen for something to drink, and she said she could get him a drink too. She wrapped a blanket around herself and headed for the kitchen. Jennifer flipped on the light, actively considering that doing so might keep him from following her, since she hadn't yet seen him in full light. When she saw the back door to her kitchen was open, she knew that's how he'd gotten in. While Jennifer fussed around for a minute or two with glasses and ice cubes, just to make some noise in the kitchen, before bolting for the back door and rushing outside. She ran to a stranger's home nearby, wrapped only in a blanket, and called the police. Jennifer Thompson was taken to the hospital early that morning for an examination and so that a rape kit could be taken. That's when they try to collect any physical evidence that may be present on the victim's body. When Jennifer was in the emergency room, she heard there was another rape victim in the hospital that same morning, a woman named Elizabeth, who police thought was probably attacked by the same man after he left Jennifer's apartment. Elizabeth lived only a half mile away from Jennifer, and maybe the rapist attacked her because he was frustrated by not being able to consummate his crime with Jennifer. Now today, many of the larger hospital emergency departments have what are called SANE nurses. That stands for Sexual Assault Nurse Examiners. These special investigators swab body parts for saliva or semen and collect other physical evidence. That might include hairs from the perpetrator or maybe fibers from his clothing. But remember, this case occurred in 1984, before DNA technology was used in forensics. So at that point, while hairs and fibers gathered in the emergency room might be helpful, the most they could get from any semen found would be the perpetrator's blood type and maybe other blood protein markers. Jennifer's next stop was the police station. She was asked to use one of those police sketch artist kits from which the witness selects facial features, like the shape of the suspect's face, the type of ears, nose, lips, hairstyle, eyebrows, or any other things the witness might have noticed. Then the selected components are put into a composite drawing. Jennifer was also questioned, not only about the rape, but also about how the physical exam had gone at the hospital. When the officer found out she had not received any penicillin to counter a sexually transmitted disease the rapist might have carried, and also had not been given the contraceptive commonly called the morning after pill, both of which are supposed to be standard parts of the treatment of any rape victim, well, they sent Jennifer to another hospital to have the entire humiliating rape kit procedure redone. It was the next day before a detective took her back to her apartment. That's when Jennifer realized for certain that her attacker had been in her house for quite a while before the rape, drinking, smoking cigarettes, and going through her personal belongings. The eyewitness details that Jennifer had given law enforcement and the sketch made from them were released to the public through the media. Based on an anonymous tip they received, police rounded up Ronald Cotton, a 22-year-old man who resembled the description and worked at a restaurant near the area where the two young women had been raped. Now, Cotton did have a breaking and entering charge on his record, as well as an attempted sexual assault charge from his teenage years, for which he served 18 months. Making suspicions even stronger, Cotton's alibi for the night of the rapes didn't pan out. The story he told police was quickly shown to be inaccurate. But in Cotton's defense, he claimed he simply made a mistake and confused a couple of days of his past week. When police brought Jennifer Thompson 6 photographs of possible suspects, they followed best practices. They told her that a rapist may or may not be among them. That's an important part of a police lineup procedure, because it doesn't force the witness to choose anyone from the group. But one of the problematic things done during the police photo presentation was that Jennifer was given all 6 images at the same time. Now, you might wonder, what's wrong with that? Well, it allows the witness to keep comparing each face against the others and use the process of elimination to exclude individuals and narrow down to one, rather than having the witness simply pick one photo from a whole group and say, that's the guy. Giving all the photos at once could be compared to a multiple choice test question, where we tend to compare the possibilities before we choose, quote, the right answer. In fact, Jennifer Thompson herself later said that she treated that photo array like a standardized test question. She compared the features of each man against the others, excluding those she was sure were not right, and settled on Ronald Cotton as the best fit to her rapist. Jennifer also said that after she chose Cotton, the police told her, well, we thought that might be the guy since he has a prior conviction. Ronald Cotton was later one of 7 similar-aged African-American males brought into the police station for Jennifer to observe. I read an interview with her in which she said she actually thought the lineup would be like what we see on TV. The men would be on the other side of a one-way piece of glass and wouldn't be able to see her. She was shocked when she had to stand in the same room and face the 7 men as each one of them held up a piece of paper with a number on it. Ronald Cotton later mentioned he was so frightened at the lineup he was visibly shaking as he stood there holding the number 5 sign. He had already been told that Jennifer had picked his image out of a photo array, and he was terrified. Each man had to step forward and then repeat a few of the lines that Jennifer had remembered from the rape so she could hear each guy's voice. Although she later admitted she very nearly picked the 4th man in the lineup, Jennifer ultimately did select Cotton. As you may have seen in legal dramas on television, police are not allowed to conclude a lineup by saying, good job, or you picked the right guy. And they certainly didn't say that to Jennifer Thompson. But when police told her she had picked the same man whose image she'd identified during the photo array, Thompson was convinced she had chosen the man who raped her, and that he would end up rotting in jail for what he had done to her and the other woman he also attacked that same night. In 1985, there was a week-long trial in which Ronald Cotton was charged with both the rape of Jennifer Thompson and the burglary of her home. Police gave testimony about Ronald Cotton's false alibi. Physical evidence was presented, including a flashlight found at Cotton's house that was alleged to be similar to one used in the rape. A small piece of foam rubber found at the scene was said to be consistent with the inside of a pair of sneakers Cotton owned. But after Jennifer Thompson actually pointed to Ronald Cotton in the courtroom and stated that he was her rapist, it took a jury just 40 minutes to find him guilty of both the rape and the burglary, for which he was sentenced to life in prison. Now, some of you may already know that things like the flashlight and foam rubber are called circumstantial indirect evidence in the courtroom. They show that the suspect may have been at the scene, but not that he definitely did the action accused. But eyewitness testimony is considered direct evidence. That's because a person testifies to what he or she directly saw, heard, felt, etc. Surprisingly to some people, tangible physical evidence, like hair, fibers, fingerprints, and even DNA, is indirect evidence because the judge and/or a jury must make an inference based on that evidence. In other words, they have to use it to draw their own conclusion, whereas eyewitness testimony, if true, is a statement of fact with no interpretation necessary. I guess it's the if true part where we really get into trouble. Not only can people lie on the witness stand, but they can also be mistaken, especially in times of extreme stress. And we all know that our senses can play tricks on us, leaving us to either doubt what we saw or to extrapolate beyond what we saw. We may simply confuse things enough to make a mistake in our recall of events. Based on everything I've read, heard, and seen, I truly believe that Jennifer Thompson acted in good faith when she chose Ronald Cotton from that photo display. And perhaps when she saw him again in the physical lineup, she more strongly recognized him because she had already seen his photograph. Either way, Thompson absolutely believed that Ronald Cotton was the man who had broken into her home and raped her, and she was glad to see him headed to prison. Once Ronald Cotton was incarcerated, he started writing to attorneys and the media, just trying to get someone, anyone, to listen to his pleas of innocence. And then one day, about a year after he entered prison, things took an unbelievable twist. Cotton saw a new inmate being brought in, and he thought the man looked kind of familiar. So Cotton walked right up to the guy and said, "Hey man, where are you from?" The man, who was named Bobby Poole, replied that he was from Burlington, North Carolina. And Cotton said, "Me too. And you look just like the police artist's sketch of the suspect in the Burlington rape that I'm sitting here in prison for but didn't do." The new inmate brushed Cotton off and denied the accusation. Later, though, Cotton heard from another prisoner that Bobby Poole admitted he was the man who had raped both Jennifer and Elizabeth on that night in July of 1984. Not only that, but other women since then, too. In fact, Poole was in prison doing two consecutive life sentences for other rapes, but joked to fellow inmates that Cotton was actually doing some of his jail time for him. Ronald Cotton soon earned a new trial, although it wasn't because of the information about Bobby Poole. In fact, although there was testimony presented at the second trial in 1987 about Poole admitting in jail to raping Jennifer Thompson, the judge removed the jury from the courtroom during that testimony. The judge ultimately did not allow them to hear or consider that as evidence. The reason Cotton was actually awarded a new trial was it had finally been revealed that Elizabeth, the second victim raped the same night as Jennifer Thompson, had picked a different man out of the police lineup, not Ronald Cotton, but that evidence had been withheld during Cotton's original trial. To make matters worse, though, by the time of the second trial, Elizabeth had come to the conclusion that Cotton had actually been her rapist on that fateful night, too. So in his 1987 trial, Ronald Cotton stood faced with not just the rape of Jennifer Thompson, as was the case at his first trial, but he was now charged with the rape of the second victim, Elizabeth, as well. This time, Elizabeth was also present in court, and although less convincingly, she too testified that Cotton was her rapist. Now, that's not to say that Bobby Poole had nothing to do with the second trial. Due to the jailhouse talk, Poole was actually brought to the courtroom, and Jennifer Thompson was asked if he could have possibly been her rapist. She replied, absolutely not. She stuck to her guns and insisted that Ronald Cotton was the man who had raped her. In fact, Jennifer later said how angry she was that the defense would bring in some other man who vaguely resembled Cotton to try to confuse the jury. How dare they do that? And how dare they doubt her word? So, in 1987, at his second trial, Ronald Cotton was convicted of not one, but two counts of rape and two counts of burglary, for which he was given two life sentences. When asked if he had anything to say to Jennifer and Elizabeth, he said he was sorry for what had happened to them, and although he had done some bad things in his life, he absolutely did not rape either of them. Back in prison, Cotton said it was not uncommon for other inmates and guards to call him Poole and also confuse Bobby Poole for being Ronald Cotton. That's how much the two men looked alike. And as the years went on, Cotton did what he could just to adjust to prison life, while Jennifer Thompson married, had triplets, and tried to put her terrible memories behind her, as much as that was possible for either of them. Then, in 1994, when most of the population of the United States and others around the world were captivated by the famous O.J. Simpson murder trial in California, Ronald Cotton learned about something that would ultimately be his salvation. He heard about the power of DNA testing in forensic cases. Richard Rosen, an attorney and law professor, agreed to help Cotton pursue DNA testing. Rosen warned him, though, that if the DNA evidence fingered Cotton as the rapist, that was the end of the line as far as any legal means to get him out of prison. Cotton insisted the test be done. When authorities went back to the rape kits from the two 1984 cases, there was a lot of degradation to the evidence after the 10 years. But within the rape kit from Elizabeth, they found a single fragment of a single sperm cell. That tiny bit of evidence yielded a DNA profile, which not only proved once and for all that Ronald Cotton was not the rapist, but showed that Bobby Poole was. Cotton was exonerated and released in June of 1995 after 10 and a half long years in prison, over a decade of his life lost. By the way, Poole later died of cancer in 2001 while still incarcerated. When she heard the news of Cotton's innocence, Jennifer Thompson felt a tremendous amount of guilt and shame. She felt like she betrayed herself and the whole judicial process. She wondered if people thought she reacted too quickly after the crime and just tried to find a man, any man, to pay for what had happened to her. She also speculated people thought she was a racist, since she's white and Cotton is black. At the same time, Jennifer also thought it ironic and even a little cruel that Ronald Cotton was now getting all the attention as a victim, as well as restitution from the state. She would never be free from what was done to her, and there was no restitution she could ever be given to compensate her for what was taken away. Those were the kinds of things Jennifer Thompson said to friends and reporters just after Ronald Cotton's release. But time has a way of changing things. And about 2 years later, Thompson did something most people could not fathom. She asked if Ronald Cotton would meet her in a neutral place for a private discussion. As she describes it, she was so nervous when she saw him that she couldn't even stand up. She started to cry and said, and I'm quoting her here, "Ron, if I spent every second of every minute of every hour for the rest of my life telling you how sorry I am. It wouldn't come close to how my heart feels. I am so sorry." And she described how Ronald Cotton took her hands and said, now I'm quoting from an interview with him, "Jennifer, I forgive you. I don't want you to look over your shoulder. I just want us to be happy and move on in life." Can you imagine? Jennifer said before she understood the power of forgiveness and mercy, she used to actually pray that Ronald Cotton would be raped and killed in prison. And now here he was, sitting across from her, telling her that he forgave her for the over 10 years of his life her mistake had cost him. Their conversation lasted 2 hours while their families waited outside. The pair hugged and promised to stay in touch when they parted. Now clearly, Jennifer Thompson and Ronald Cotton learned a lot about themselves and each other from this life-altering experience. But what about the rest of us in the justice system in general? What have we learned from situations like this? Well, it's long been known that eyewitness testimony is problematic. Many scientists, particularly, most famously, forensic psychologist Elizabeth Loftus, have extensively studied the phenomenon. They've even pinpointed specific facets of the issue, such as that people tend to differentiate the faces of people from their own race better than they can make distinctions among faces of people from other races. Now, maybe that's simply because we tend to spend more time around people who look more like us, often beginning with our own family. Loftus thinks that when an individual sees a person of a different race, the primary things noticed are the main, or what we might even say stereotypical characteristics associated with that race. For instance, a Caucasian might note eye shape and hair form in Asians. We don't focus on the other details. Now, during a lineup, when multiple people from that race are presented together, we can't differentiate because we never focused on the finer details in the first place. Could that have played into Jennifer Thompson's original misidentification, even though she said she studied all the details of her attacker's face? It's also known that human memory is pretty malleable. I'm sure you know this yourself. As we sit and ponder something that happened or try to recall someone we saw, our mind can easily distort the details, especially if new information is coming in. We begin to confuse or blend the original story or image with that new data. When she reviewed the photo lineup, Jennifer Thompson quickly eliminated 4 of the 6 images, but then spent close to 5 minutes comparing the mental image she had of a rapist to the last of those 2 photographs. That shows a pretty significant degree of uncertainty. Jennifer explained she just wanted to be right about her conclusion. But experts have noted that a witness who at first may be uncertain can often become more certain over time. It's as if we want so badly to be sure that we subconsciously force ourselves to become more confident in our assertions. And later, when Ronald Cotton was the only one of those 6 guys in the photos who she saw again at the physical lineup, well, she became even more convinced she was right. And by the time she got to the steps of the courthouse, she was 100% sure, even though she originally spent almost 5 minutes comparing 2 men depicted in the photo array. But when you think about it, and this was even pointed out to Jennifer by Mike Galden, who was the detective assigned to her case, Jennifer was definitely not the only one who made a big mistake. The detective himself also believed Cotton was her rapist, as did other police officers. And the 2 judges and 2 juries who heard the 2 legal cases against Cotton, well, they were also wrong in their guilty verdicts. That's why everyone, law enforcement, officers, investigators, attorneys, juries, and judges, should take very seriously what we all intuitively know. Human memory is not infallible. We definitely need eyewitness testimony in criminal cases, but we must all realize how faulty it can be. Since the time Ronald Cotton gained his freedom, several 100 people have been exonerated through DNA testing. About 3/4 of those people were convicted partly by faulty eyewitness identification, making it the most common source of wrongful convictions in the legal system. Even more shocking still, in almost 40% of those cases, more than one eyewitness incorrectly identified the same innocent person as being the perpetrator. Sadly, studies by organizations like the Innocence Project in New York estimate that only 5 to 10% of criminal cases have any type of physical evidence that could yield DNA. And much of that evidence may now already be degraded or have been destroyed. So armed with this kind of knowledge, and to atone in a very personal way for her error that cost Ronald Cotton over 10 years of freedom, Jennifer Thompson has devoted her life to talking to anyone who will listen about the mistakes she made. She regularly speaks at conferences to make those involved in the legal system aware of the pitfalls of convictions based solely or too heavily on eyewitness testimony. She also opposes the death penalty, since we have no way to know how many innocent people may have already been executed without the truth ever coming out. Through their story and activism, both Thompson and Cotton have lobbied for reform in police procedures, especially those involving eyewitness identification. Among the suggestions they and other advocates have made are that victim lineup photos need to be presented one at a time, what's called a sequential lineup, as opposed to simultaneous lineups where all images or all people are presented together. Also, officers presenting lineups should be blind to who the real suspect in the group is, to avoid any subconscious cues they might be sending to the witness. Some agencies have adopted a new software system for conducting photo lineups that was partly designed by Mike Golden, the detective in the Jennifer Thompson case. It involves no human cues. It presents lineup images on a computer screen, one at a time, and there's just a yes, no, and not sure button that the witness selects regarding recognition of each face shown. The work that Thompson and Cotton have done together, including their 2009 book titled Picking Cotton, has helped prompt reform of police procedures in some parts of the country. But many agencies still seem to resist suggested changes. Cotton's attorney, Richard Rosen, says it's important to all of society that mistaken identity be averted, and not just for the wrongfully accused, the victim, and the judicial system. The danger to all of us, and the reason we should all support suggested reforms in police and judicial procedures, is because when police settle on the wrong person, it allows the real perpetrator to harm others. That's what let Bobby Poole go on to rape again and again. In fact, the Innocence Project estimates that when misidentification causes an innocent person to be incarcerated, almost half of the guilty perpetrators who were later convicted by DNA evidence went on to engage in additional violent crimes while the innocent person sat in prison. After being released from prison, Ronald Cotton got a job with the DNA testing company that performed the analysis that earned his exoneration. The state of North Carolina awarded him $110,000 in restitution. But that was only after Jennifer Thompson lobbied for an increase to the original $5,000 he was given. Cotton married, had a daughter, and to this day, his and Thompson's families are friends. To me, the biggest surprise of this story is Cotton's seeming lack of bitterness about this tragedy that was caused by a woman's flawed memory, and how together he and Jennifer have advocated for changes in relevant police and legal procedures. As the Innocence Project has wisely concluded, quote, memory is evidence and must be handled as carefully as the crime scene itself to avoid forever altering it.